Hello, and welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass, Overcoming Bias at Work. Joining us today is Dr. Tiffany Jana, CEO and President of TMI Consulting, a diversity and inclusion firm based in Richmond, Virginia. She's the author of several books tackling this topic, including Overcoming Bias, Building Authentic Relationships Across Differences, and most recently of Erasing Institutional Bias, How to Create Systemic Change for Organizational Inclusion. We're grateful to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's such an honor to be here.
So if we can dive right in, why don't we go ahead and define what we mean by bias?
So bias is simply a preference for one thing over another, or a dislike of one thing over another. And some, there are different kinds of biases in these preferences. Some of them are overt biases. The things that you know you like and the things that you know you don't like are just biases in general. And the biases that I'm interested in studying for the purpose of creating greater workplace integration and inclusion is unconscious bias. These are the biases of which we are less aware, but still can be adversely affecting the people around us. We can unintentionally be treating people differently or less than as a result of biases that we're not even aware of.
Can you share an example of unconscious bias from your own life?
Sure. There was an example that I actually give in my in the book Overcoming Bias, the first book I wrote. I had a job when I was in high school working for a haute couture designer. And there was a particular demographic of women who used to come into the store and really demand these discounts. And this is the thing about bias, is it comes from somewhere, either an experience or something you've heard, things that you've accumulated over time. But essentially, I was put under tremendous pressure by one particular demographic of people who always wanted discounts. And obviously, if I gave them discounts on the ticketed price, I would lose my job. And it came to the point where I started to become anxious every time I saw that demographic walking into the store, because I was bracing for this interaction that was going to be exhausting and stressful for me. Then I started to notice over time that when I saw anyone of that demographic out in the world, that same anxiety response would surface. And so I developed, without being aware of it until much, much later, I developed a bias against an entire group of people based on a set of experiences that I had in high school. So I would actually, when given the opportunity to, you know, sort of have a friendship or, you know, just trust someone blindly, if they represented that demographic, I was less likely to do it. And I didn't figure that out until much later. So without meaning to be unkind, without meaning to be aloof or dismissive, I was actually treating people differently than I, you know, in my conscious life as a good person, would want to treat people.
That's very surprising given your career trajectory.
Absolutely.
I mean, if it can happen to someone like you.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this began before I started this career, and it was something I realized before I really launched into it. But for me, it was the most poignant example. And the reason for the subtitle in my first book, Building Authentic Relationships Across Differences, it took sitting on a board of directors with a young man who represented that demographic and developing a sustained relationship and ultimately friendship over time that caused me to really realize, I noticed that I had these feelings of mistrust and anxiety that weren't rooted in the experience I was having with that particular person. And I really had to go back and mine my hard drive, you know, my mental, emotional hard drive for where this was coming from. And once I built a relationship with someone from that demographic, that all began to melt away. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, the source code for whatever this is, this bias in my mind, is flawed. And it certainly is limiting and not allowing people to be who they are.
So is that typically how bias forms? Is it from an actual negative experience, or are there other ways?
There are so many ways. So our brains are just, we're taking in so much data all the time. And in this day and age, as human beings, we are accumulating and being exposed to more data than the human, you know, human race has ever been exposed to before. And so any point at which you are receiving data, you are potentially building up new biases and reinforcing old biases. So you are receiving bias messages through the media. You are reading them through everything you read, hear, consume, watch. You get you can receive biases through, you know, your houses of worship, your teachers, your school's educational process. And then, of course, the people who love you the most, the people who are, you know, who are on this to help you thrive and make it through life in the most successful way possible, your parents or caretakers, actually, you know, transmit their biases on to you. If they had negative experiences over the course of their lives with any particular group of people, then they're likely to share that with you. And because we blindly trust our parents to keep us safe, we take those on sometimes. That's why you see a lot of young people coming of age and questioning their parents' values, because they're starting to question for the first time, hey, wait a minute, you know, I have friends from these demographics and this doesn't make any sense. The interesting thing about bias is, you know, bias is not limited to people. When we're talking about flavors of ice cream, nobody cares. You know, I prefer chocolate ice cream over strawberry, and that's not a big deal. The problem is that our preferences don't stop when we get to people. And we're talking about, you know, immutable characteristics that exist within people, or things over which they don't have control, or even sometimes things they do have control over. Having biases and allowing ourselves to treat folks differently because of things that we're not aware of is really difficult. One of the things that I like to highlight in the context of both my writings and my talks is that, by and large, the people who I've interacted with on the six continents that I've lived on and worked on and traveled on is that people, by and large, feel like they're good people. Yeah, there's a handful of folks, you know, here and there who, you know, really want to cause folks harm, but that's not the vast majority of the human race. Most of us are trying not to cause harm and just trying to make it through life another day, maybe take care of ourselves and our families. And as good people, people generally are, you know, trying to treat other people well. They might bump up against their own foibles and their own shortcomings, but they're not trying to just run around hurting people all day. So as a good person, one of the things that, you know, that I sort of challenge people to look at is, what is your responsibility for recognizing that unconscious bias is not, it's not something that we choose. It's just a function of being human. It is something that is a result of our brain wiring. And while it is not something that we do deliberately, these biases are not anything that we accumulate deliberately. They're actually a set of shortcuts designed to allow us to make rapid decisions and move through life more smoothly. We do, in my opinion, have a responsibility to figure out what those biases are and actually address them so that we are not unintentionally causing harm. And to me, once you have this information and you're aware of it, you do actually have a responsibility to do something about it. I generally, you know, like to tell people, because I work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, issues of, you know, race and class and, you know, the, you know, homophobia and all of the gender bias, all of these things play directly into the work that I look at and the situations that I help try to resolve and mitigate and prevent. And if nobody, arguably no one on the planet right now created any of these isms. No one created these ways of being, or even the structural stuff, the institutional stuff. The second book I wrote is Erasing Institutional Bias. How does this play out at the organizational level? How do we embed bias into our systems? We do it every day, but none of us actually created it. None of us originated it. So feeling bad about it and feeling guilty or feeling are not useful constructs. So I believe that while we didn't create it, we do have a responsibility to address it.
How does unconscious bias play out in the workplace?
So the interesting thing is, you know, sometimes you'll hear people say, you know what, people just need to, you know, leave their home stuff at home and bring their work stuff to work. And they need to leave that personal, you know, stuff behind, whatever. It's impossible. It's really impossible. Precisely because of issues like this. People, you know, if people are stressed out, it's coming to the workplace. You know, if people are really happy and excited and engaged, it's coming to the workplace. If people are thinking about, you know, their divorce or their kid's disciplinary action. It's coming to the workplace. We're carrying all that baggage with us. And just like those things are true, whatever biases you might have, overt or unconscious, that you are dragging them with you in your briefcase or in your backpack, you know, or in your pocket and bringing them into the workplace. So depending on what those messages are that you received over time through the media or through your parents or through religion, whatever the case may be, depending on what those messages are, you are bringing them into the workplace and they are potentially influencing the way that you treat people. So the crazy thing is that things like gender bias, for instance, gender bias is really interesting because there's a wonderful example actually comes out of Yale where somebody decided to study the effects of unconscious bias. And they thought, let's use professors working in the sciences because those folks are taught to be objective. If we can get any, you know, objective feedback, we're going to get it from these professors. And so these professors were given two sets. There were two sets of resumes, Jane and a John, right? The contents of the resumes were identical. Each professor only received one, but there were two different, that were available that they could have received. The only thing they were asked to do was rate how competent they thought the applicant was for, I think it was a position in a lab, how much they would offer them as a starting salary, and whether or not they would actually hire them. And, as you can probably guess, based on, what you know and you've seen in the news around all of the different biases and gender and how they show up in the workplace, the female candidate was consistently rated as less competent than John, who had the same resume. And again, they didn't see both. That was just blindly, they felt like this person was less competent. They were less likely to hire her. And they started her at a less salary, statistically significantly less salary than they would start the male with the identical qualifications. And the most fascinating part about that study to me is that female professors were just as likely to downrate Jennifer as the male professors were. And this is an illustration of what happens when the messages that we get from society, the messages that we get from media, the messages that we get from all over the world and whatever sources are informing us, if you're a member of that particular, let's say, marginalized community, you're not immune from that messaging. So just because you're a woman does not mean that you're not likely to internalize the messages of bias against your own demographic. To me, that's really scary.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that the work of overcoming bias has to be self-directed. You can't force other people to change. So how then can management foster a spirit of fairness and inclusion and appropriate hiring and reviewing practices without sort of alienating people?
So the interesting thing is that as an organization, people have, the leadership has no right to tell people what to believe or how to think, right? The fact is that leadership does have the ability and the responsibility to dictate behavior. How people are going to act in the workplace is absolutely within the purview, the scope of things that management can mandate. So while you don't have to tell anybody what they can believe, for instance, when you think about the LGBTQIA issues, right? You've got folks who, you find folks who maybe do not agree with, whatever, inclusion for LGBT folks and their allies. And a lot of people, so I happen to live in the South. I'm in Richmond, Virginia. I went to high school in New York. My mom's from New York, so I've been North and been South and East and West. And I know that in this part of the world, it's not uncommon for folks to cite their religious beliefs as the reason why they don't want to be inclusive of, LGBTQ people. And so someone might say, I'm not willing to, work on a team or be assigned to work with this person because they're gay and that's against my religion. Well, guess what? depending on what state you're in, depending on, which type of organization you work for and the protections that are allowed, some of these identities are, you know, protected categories, and you don't make hiring, firing, or job assignment decisions based on people's, you know, sexual orientation or gender expression, things like that. And the interesting thing is I happen to be a Christian woman, and, you know, I do not begrudge anyone their right to express themselves religiously or not in any way that they choose. But in my research and exposure around the world, I haven't met a whole lot of major world religions that say because of who someone is, you need to treat them badly. That's not generally how that goes. And so the ability to tell people, hey, we're going to treat our colleagues with respect. We are going to, you know, invite them to the work. We're going to be inclusive. We're going to make room for people. We're not going to use names or slurs, et cetera. These are things that the organization can do. And as far as not alienating employees, if leadership focuses on what kind of experience do we want our employees, our colleagues to have? How do we want people to feel as they are doing the work? While everyone is there to achieve the mission, to drive towards the goal, the vision, the values, all of those things, it is important to make sure that we're not just focusing on the customer, that we're also focusing on the very people, the human capital, the talent, the minds, and the hearts who are getting the work done. What experience do we want them to have? And if you begin to define that experience very clearly, and you lean into, you know, articulating values that are inclusive and that are welcoming, then when you ask people to lean into those behaviors, it's not alienating because it benefits everybody. In my company's sort of way of looking at things, TMI Consulting, we define diversity as all of the ways that we are both similar and different. We don't focus just on the differences or just on marginalized groups or just on the Title VII protected categories. We focus on all of the ways that we are both similar and different, because you cannot have a diversity, inclusion, unconscious bias conversation without making room for everyone. We are not diverse if we're not talking about every single person that makes up the organization. So when people feel like they're part of the conversation and they're included, whether they're white or black or green or polka dotted, it makes them feel safer and more like this is something that benefits them. It shouldn't just benefit a particular group or just a marginalized group. Everyone ultimately benefits from inclusive behavior and inclusive workplaces.
Can you say more about that, about why it behooves an organization's leadership to take this issue seriously?
It behooves them to take it seriously because, I mean, we have mountains and mountains of data that tell us that, you know, diverse workplaces, diverse environments have better outcomes, stronger bottom lines, stronger cultures, and inclusion. So the mitigating bias is an inclusion conversation. That is about how we treat people and how we welcome them to the work. Inclusion increases employee engagement. And these are the things that affect your turnover. These are the things that affect, you know, employee well-being, their likelihood to refer other people, to stay in the organization, to rise through leadership. So the conversation about bias creates room for people to thrive and to grow within the context of the organization. And, you know, if you're addressing things like this, because everybody has bias, if you've got, you know, clear policy and you're, you know, providing things like unconscious bias training, then you are creating an environment where when people bump against each other, as they are inevitably going to do, that you've created a situation where people can have open conversations and where we can deal with things before they rise to the level of showing up on the front page and affecting your, you know, your stock prices, right? So it's all around good in so many different ways. And that's why there's just so much research and so many people are spending, you know, really good resources on creating diversity, equity, and inclusion strategies, because it really does help create, you know, a healthy, well-functioning workplace. And at the end of the day, I mean, once upon a time, this conversation was about social justice and doing the right thing by people. And I still think that that's perfectly wonderful. If you want to do this because it's the right thing, by all means do it. But by the end of the day, I'm also a businesswoman, and it is good for business. Diversity and inclusion are very, very good for business. The more different kinds of people you have who are able to feel welcome and not threatened in the workplace, the more ideas you're going to get, you're actually going to be more relevant in the market. You're going to attract different types of clients, different types of employees, and you're going to have a broader reach. So it is all around a really fantastic thing, which is part of the reason that it's getting so much airplay at the moment.
For those listeners who are not in management or positions of authority within their organizations, how do you recommend getting your organization to address this?
Interestingly, I actually wrote both of those, both of my books on bias were written from that perspective. So Overcoming Bias was written from the perspective of I'm an individual and, you know, I'm interested in this conversation about bias. What do I do? And so with Overcoming Bias, that book takes you through the steps of defining it, of identifying your own bias and step-by-step mitigating each of those biases. And then you rinse and repeat because we're accumulating them all the time. And then the second book, Erasing Institutional Bias, was written to address exactly what you just said. I'm just a regular person at an organization, but I can see that, you know, for instance, gender bias is playing out, a racial bias is playing out and adversely affecting the organization. I care about the mission. I care about the vision. I care about my colleagues. What can I do? And so there's a series of steps that that book takes the reader through to help actually get buy-in and do something about it. You know, just some examples of some of the things that they can do. The first thing that you have to do if you're taking on this work is really look at your own perspective. Because as you are going down this path, people are going to want to look at your flaws. So if you're going to engage in a conversation around unconscious bias, particularly if it has to do with any kind of protected category, marginalized demographic, then you do need to examine your own role. You need to educate yourself as much as possible about the conversation and figure out how you personally may or may not be contributing to the systemic bias that you're kind of going to be calling out. The next thing that we ask people to do is to actually lead with data. So my companies, TMI Consulting and Loom Technologies, we focus on data first because, like, historically, my industry just kind of, we would go in, people go in and they just kind of intuit what the problem is and just throw training at it and then leave. And that's insufficient. How do you know when you've made a difference? How do you know if you've been effective? How do you create sustainable change? Well, we do that using metrics. And so if you see that there's racial bias, for instance, you suspect that something's going on in the organization, collect the data that you need to do that. So if it's, you know, we only see, you know, visible diversity at the lowest parts of the organization. And as you go higher up in the organization, all you see are, you know, majority demographics. Maybe all you see are white women at the top of the organization. And so maybe we have a gender thing going on. Maybe we have a race thing going on. But start to look at what data you can get a hold of and lead with data. And then you want to actually build, you want to find some allies and build like a coalition of people who are like-minded. Other people, you know, if you're seeing this challenge, there might be other folks. So, you know, whether, you know, human resources or other colleagues or, you know, other key influencers who are interested in whatever the challenge is, getting some traction behind what you're pointing out. It's useful to not be just a lone player. If you're just one guy standing up and saying, hey, I think my whole organization might be racist, well, it's very easy to make that one guy silent or make that one guy disappear. But if you have if you've got buy-in from different parts of the organization and you've got data, that makes it a little bit more difficult. So Erasing Institutional Bias, How to Create Systemic Change for Organizational Inclusion is all about the individual sort of looking at a systemic challenge and doing something about it.
We're hearing the word intersectionality a lot these days. And obviously the conferences for women are about women, helping women. It's a very gender specific thing. For women who maybe see some kind of gender-based bias in their workplace or, you know, throughout the world, is it possible to address that without also addressing biases against other groups, racial bias, you know, bias around sexuality, disability?
Is it possible? I mean, it is. I don't actually recommend it. I do get clients that come to me and they're just like, well, we only have a gender problem and we want to address, and this particular one is, you know, getting a lot of traction, the kind of, especially with hashtag Me Too and all the things that are going on. People want to just isolate gender, for instance. I feel like personally that is ill-advised because, you know, what you want to do is, I mean, if you have absolute, you know, sort of irrefutable evidence that no other demographic is feeling marginalized and that there is not any other bias at play, then that would probably be the exception. If you've got, you know, strong visible diversity in all of the other ways and you've got invisible diversity and people are otherwise thriving, but the only demographic that is clearly left behind is you know, women or, you know, or gender non-conforming people, transgender folks, whatever, if that's your issue, then fine. Address that on its own. My strategy is generally, and this is again why we lead with data. If people don't have the ability to accumulate the data or don't know what data to collect, you know, the TMI portfolio of companies has the ability to go in and actually provide assessments that do that for you. But often what we find through the assessment process and through further inquiry is that when you have one demographic that is kind of standing out as not having a great time in the workplace, that's usually indicative of non-inclusive behavior in across the board that is affecting other demographics. So one of the reasons that people sometimes like to choose the gender issue is because it's less threatening than, for instance, the race issue. Mm-hmm. In the United States in particular, our racial conversation is lagging so far behind. We've got so much pain and so much baggage that we haven't dealt with that it is positively fraught. So people are terrified of that conversation. It's easier to talk about gender than it is to talk about race. So let's just talk about that and leave the other thing lying. Well, what you do in that case, if race is a conversation you still need to have and people are being marginalized, you know, as a result, then you're going to create further animosity and you're going to create a festering wound by privileging one identity over another. That's what happens when you isolate. When you say, we're just going to focus on that, you are saying this identity and this pain is more important than this identity and this pain that you might be feeling over here on the side. So my recommendation for people is, if you've got bias, it's showing up, it's touching on these demographics, then you have a diversity, equity, and inclusion challenge, and you need to be looking at creating a strategy for intervention and improvement around diversity, equity, and inclusion, full stop. Something that is comprehensive, something that is far more holistic than pigeonholing one demographic and making everyone feel like they don't matter, everyone else feel like they don't matter.
Great point. Now we have time for only about two more questions. So I'm going to pivot to more relational kind of between and among employees mm-hmm. issues. You mentioned animosity and as we all know, a lot of the current conversation around race, sex, privilege have taken place largely in anonymous forms such as Twitter, where what should be a nuanced and compassionate conversation sounds a lot more like a shouting match. So in this context, I imagine a lot of people are fearful of having open conversations about bias. What if you end up unintentionally offending someone? Or what if you end up on YouTube or in the newspaper, you know? So how can we navigate today's workplace in this context without this fear?
Honestly, I think that it's too late to navigate it without fear because we've created a scary atmosphere. We've waited too long to allow women to have a voice and gender nonconforming people to have a voice. We've waited too long to have the really deep apologetic conversations about race, you know, nationality and things like that. And so now we have a situation where the backlash is brutal, and it is and can be a very scary conversation. The important thing, I think, has more to do with being settled in yourself and understanding your own intentions. So, you know, there's a wonderful book called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. It's a tiny, tiny book, and I highly recommend it for anyone who's human and alive. And one of the things that Don Miguel Ruiz, one of the four agreements, is don't take things personally. And basically, he encourages us not to take things personally because when people, you know, sort of push things at you, it has more to do with where they are and what they're going through than it has anything to do with you. And your choice to respond and sort of take offense is the choice that you have. Now, that doesn't mean don't take it seriously. Should you offend someone? You absolutely should. And if you realize that you've offended someone, then you need to apologize and find out what you did that you could possibly do better next time. If you are the one who is taking offense, then you need to do the work personally to figure out what it is that is going on with you. And you can choose, like, 1,007 things can happen to you in the course of 24 hours or 24 years. The reaction that you have to those things that happen is more what defines you. So choosing to stay out of offense and recognize, you know, what you want to do in the workplace is cultivate strong relationships to the extent that you're able to, because, you know, we navigate these things with our friends and family all the time. People hurt each other, they offend each other, they say stupid things, and, you know, we figure it out, we get annoyed for a little while, we work it out, and we keep moving, because those relationships have legs, because we have a vested interest in not being eternally pissed off at our sister. So we need to start to embrace our work family as exactly that, as more of a family. Like I tell people all the time, if I could distill everything that I'm invited to go and help mitigate, deal with, address, prevent in the context of the worst place down to some core tenets, the biggest thing I would say is that in the workplace, we cease to experience each other's humanity. We cease to respect each other's humanity and allow the room and the grace for people to just be people. And people sometimes mess up. And so, one, be more gracious and allow people to learn and to grow and to sometimes mess up. And for yourself, examine your own heart and figure out what your motives actually are. If you are moving forward, attempting to get to know people, attempting to work in a good way, and your motives are good, if you're asking questions about, you know, their experience as, you know, some kind of a whatever demographic, make sure that you're not just trying to be curious, or you're not just being a looky-loo. You're not just, you know, being nosy. Make sure that if you're trying to move into that relationship, you're really trying to get to know that person, and that there is a genuine extension of care and affection, because people can read the nonverbal. So the way that you move through and move, and you don't move without fear. You're not going to have this conversation without fear. You're going to have it in spite of. You're going to have it anyway. Courage is not the absence of fear. It is moving forward deliberately, intentionally, with purpose in the face of the fear.
What do you do in the moment when you can tell that someone is dismissing you or disrespecting you because of their own bias?
You make an appointment to talk to your counselor. No. No. In the moment, if you're feeling you know, unfairly dismissed or disrespected, this is when you have to lean on your understanding of who you are and your own self-worth. You cannot allow other people's bias and other people's issues to define who you are. So, you know, what you absolutely don't want to do is you want to keep from being triggered and dropping into that amygdala, that reptilian brain. If you find yourself, you know, sweating or your voice going up or getting agitated, all that good information that you got from, you know, your grandma or your kindergarten or third grade teacher, where you take a deep breath or 10 deep breaths, you go for a walk. If you're feeling like you've been triggered, you need to actually just remove yourself from the situation. There's very little, once you have been set off emotionally, that you can do to make that situation better. If you're a particularly courageous person who's dealt with this a lot, and you want to maybe ouch, then educate. If you want to say literally maybe ouch, and then let the person know what they did, that can be helpful. If you can pull that, if you can summon that, then, you know, you can say, hey, you know, you may not be aware of this. That's a sentence stem that I really enjoy. So you may not be aware of this, but that term that you just used, can be seen as offensive by some demographics, or I really don't appreciate it when you call me little miss or whatever it is. Right. So you can do that and then walk away, or you can just go and collect yourself and maybe address it later, but it depends on your personal disposition.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. This is a conversation that we hope to continue within and without the conferences for women. Dr. Jonna, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.